Welcome to AFP Audio, and I'm speaking with Dr. Sarah Skinner, who's a consultant radiologist at Bendigo Health Medical Imaging in Bendigo, Victoria. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to your excellent article in our June issue, Survival Radiology for GPs, which I note is based on a lecture series by one of the doctors at your hospital, Damien Cleave.
Yes, that's right. Damien's been giving these talks for a long, long while and finds that they always get good feedback for revision of basic radiology that people see day to day, so it's quite a good topic.
Very useful for GPs who are going to be doing basic x-rays.
Mm.
So it's obviously difficult to talk about films without looking at them, but perhaps we could go through some of the take-home messages from this article.
Yes.
In case one, there's a Monteggia fracture, so it's a forearm fracture,
yes.
and there's a point around looking for a second fracture. Could
yes.
you just go into that a bit more detail?
So very frequently, particularly where there are a number of bones involved in the functional integrity of that joint or the joints, there are often more than one fracture, so there'll be one obvious fracture, but there may be a fracture or dislocation elsewhere. And the Monteggia fracture and its companion, the Galeazzi fracture, which is where the radius is fractured, are classic examples of that, where there are fairly subtle abnormalities in terms of the dislocated radial head in the Monteggia fracture, and in the Galeazzi fracture, the dislocated distal radial ulnar joint. And if you're not careful about having exactly orthogonal views, and this is particularly relevant for GPs taking their own x-rays, then you'll miss those dislocations, and they do have very severe functional significance. So when there are two bones, often, and this happens, of course, with the tibia and fibula, but also in the pelvic ring, there's very frequently another fracture that can be occult, so you have to be quite careful to check those bones or perhaps to go on to other imaging if you suspect there may be another fracture or dislocation elsewhere.
Mm. So the mandible as well?
The mandible is another area where things are often very confusing. The x-rays are confusing. Perhaps the GPs are not going to be taking those x-rays for themselves, but frequently in fact, there's almost universally another fracture. If you see a fracture of the mandibular body, there'll be another one that you can't see. And often we find it difficult to see them as well and requires further imaging, perhaps extra views or further CT imaging to work that out. Often, usually there's in the mandible, there are two fractures, but their second fracture may well be the mandibular condyle or somewhere close to the TMJ, the temporomandibular joint, so those fractures are quite difficult to perceive, particularly dislocation, because of all the overlapping structures. So you do just need to be aware of that, and if the patient has obvious fracture or is unable to open the mouth, you would need to be going on and asking for advice and perhaps doing some further imaging to find that second fracture.
So it's just that concept that there's a ring and
and
multiple areas that...
They form a functional ring, if you like. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
And table one, you've got a checklist, a useful checklist for GPs for interpreting extremity x-rays.
Yeah.
What are the important things there?
So the first point, of course, is to make sure you've got the correct patient, because mistakes are made, perhaps not when you're taking it yourself, but particularly if someone else is taking it on your behalf. So there's always a name on the film, so it's always good to check that it is the patient and that the abnormalities fit the clinical picture. The second point is, as I alluded to before, that you need a minimum of two views that preferably are orthogonal, meaning that they're at 90 degrees to one another, and then you've got the best chance of seeing malalignment and also fractures, because they're sometimes not seen in one view. The third point is about the fat pad sign, and I think we might get into that in a moment, but to know the common fat pads around joints, because if they are distorted or displaced, then it's an indicator that there may be a fracture that is difficult to see. Then you would run your eye along the cortices carefully, along every cortex, around every bone, around the wrist, in the carpus in particular, to see whether you can see any steps or defects in the cortex. And then to check the margins of the image, and that's a principle in all radiology, because often at the corner of the film there's another abnormality, and that's particularly relevant in those ring systems like the forearm, the leg, the pelvic ring, that you are looking at all those areas that you know reminding yourself that there are other areas that might have an abnormality and that may be missed if you don't have a systematic approach.
Mm. And the fat pads, our case study 3 demonstrates that. Particular the sale sign. Could you tell us a bit more about those? And
so in case study 3, I've used an elbow x-ray to illustrate this very important point, and that's one of the areas of the body where we are most familiar with fat pads, but they're also around the wrist as well, around the scaphoid, the pronator fat pad, which is ventral to the radius, and they're all very handy signs to indicate when a fracture is present. And for example, if I just digress for a moment to the scaphoid, if you think there is a fracture yet you can't see one, then the fact that you've got an abnormality of the soft tissues around it makes you even more suspicious. So with the elbow, there are 2 fat pads that we look for. The anterior fat pad, that is anterior to the distal humerus, is something that you see normally, but it's normally quite small. And when there's a joint effusion or hemarthrosis present, that fat pad is elevated by the presence of the effusion and the distension of the capsule. So instead of being almost parallel to the ventral surface of the humerus, it becomes elevated into a more of a blob or a sail, as if you've got one of those spinnaker sails, I think they're called in yachting. So if that's elevated, then you know there's a hemarthrosis present, and it's a very, very strong indicator that there is a fracture present, even if you're not able to discern it on that particular view. And when I'm talking about the fat pad signs, I'm talking about the lateral view. So again, we have to be quite careful we get the patient positioned correctly so that the humerus is truly lateral, otherwise we may distort and not be able to see that fat pad.
Mm.
Now, the second fat pad around the elbow is the posterior fat pad, and that is never seen normally. So if you see a fat pad posterior to the distal humerus, then you know, again, that's another indication of an effusion being present. And in terms of determining whether whether something's fat or not, of course, you've got to remember there are a number of densities on the x-ray, the white bone, black air that you see mostly in the chest, but of course when you're doing an extremity you always see some air around it, and then there's some greys in between, and the soft tissues and the muscle are more white like bone and the fat is more grey like air, so you're able to see the difference between fat and muscle, soft tissue, and that's how you find the fat pads. So very frequently they're abnormal in fracture, and very frequently in the radial head fracture, or perhaps in children, the supracondylar fractures, which sometimes can be quite difficult to perceive as well. So very important sign to look for, and just basic x-ray interpretation.
And figure 4 in the article is very good demonstration of the fat pad signs in the elbow.
Yes.
So systematic approaches are obviously very important in looking at x-rays.
Yes.
Case study 5, you talk about a shoulder dislocation and perhaps a systematic approach to the shoulder x-ray.
Yeah. So with the shoulder, it's a tricky one often, because when it's normal, it's easy, but when it's not normal, it can be very difficult to interpret. And the reason for that is that when someone does have a dislocation, they find it very difficult to be positioned or to move their arm in any way, and that makes it very difficult for the radiographer to position them appropriately. So that's where a systematic approach is very important, particularly to the lateral view. And they're very confusing, I think, even to doctors very frequently looking at x-rays. It can be quite difficult. And when you have a systematic approach and do it the same way every time, then you'll know, you'll be confident that you are doing the right thing. So in interpreting, first of all, you often do look at the AP view, because we're quite familiar with that. It looks a bit more anatomical. And what you notice in anterior dislocation is that the round humeral head is projected more medially, and it lies over the top of the glenoid of the scapula. But when you go then to the lateral view, what you need to look for is the position of the scapula relative to the humeral head. And so first of all, you just go to the scapula and find the landmarks that you know. And those landmarks will be the acromion, the coracoid process, which is anterior, and the body of the scapula. And they form a Y if you draw lines along their axes, and they intersect at the Y. And then if you then position the Y, and even in the most difficult radiographs, and there is quite a good example of this in the article, where it is quite difficult to interpret, you then look for the round humeral head, and that humeral head must lie over the intersection of the Y, the central of the Y. And if it's not lying over the centre of the Y, then it is by definition dislocated. So that's the approach to use there. And even in the most, as I said, even in the most difficult cases like this one, you can clearly see if you use that approach that the alignment is quite abnormal. This is very relevant for the posterior dislocation, which is quite rare in comparison to anterior dislocations. It's something that occurs with a much more posterior force than we tend to get, or posteriorly directed force, as opposed to the anteriorly directed force that people experience, say, in football injuries or whatever. But on the AP view in a posterior dislocation, things just look just a bit odd and not obviously abnormal in some ways. The glenohumeral joint space looks widened, and the humeral head is often rotated to give a slightly unusual appearance. Looks a bit like a tennis racket, or an old-style tennis racket anyway. So the AP view can be quite, quite subtle, and whereas the lateral view, again, if you use that approach, you'll know every time that you've got an abnormality.
If you look for the Y and the ball in the middle of it.
Ball, correct.
And the other take-home message, I think, in this case is the need to do x-rays after relocation.
Yes, well, frequently the relocation is not successful first time, and so you want to be sure that you've got good relocation. I mean, it's not always the case in youngsters. It's perhaps a little bit more simple, especially if they've done it many times before and have a lax capsule, but often the elderly patients, there might be soft tissue in the way, or there's a bone fragment very frequently, and that's the take-home message for post-procedure x-rays too, that often you'll initially, when there's a dislocation, you won't see the fractures that are present. But when you do the post-relocation x-rays, you'll see those fractures
become more obvious.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the following cases from that one is around the cervical spine.
Yeah.
And I guess the first question with any neck injury is a cervical spine imaging, is cervical spine imaging necessary?
Yeah.
And there's some established criteria to tell us that.
Yeah, well, there's an excellent article, I think it was in the April issue, if I'm not wrong, about imaging the cervical spine and trauma. And there are, happily, established criteria for whether you need to do imaging or not, and I guess that's the first question. So people mostly in Australia are using the Nexus criteria. It's very well established in large series, so that if you don't have any of the Nexus criteria, if none of them are present, then you do not need to image. But if any of the criteria are present, then you do need to image. So those criteria are in Table 2, and they include midline cervical tenderness on palpation, if they've got, the patient has a focal neurological deficit, paresthesia, any kind of obviously weakness, any ridiculous symptoms, so they've got pain radiating down the arm or if it's lower down the legs, etc. The patient's intoxicated in any way, obviously that includes alcohol but also includes drugs and iatrogenic intoxication as well. So if you've given them morphine and you can't assess them, then that's another positive nexus criterion. If they've got a painful distracting injury, so that's any injury that might distract them from any symptoms in their cervical spine, and it's very typically a serious long bone fracture or burns or visceral injury that is more severe to them, then that would fit the criteria to be imaged. And then the final major criterion is altered mental state. So if they've got a Glasgow Coma Scale score of less than 15, then they would routinely require imaging. So you can see actually it's a very large group of people that require imaging for assessment of the cervical spine.
And includes our case study seven patient because he's intoxicated.
Yeah, exactly. So any of those criteria, if they're present, then they require imaging. So then the choice is what sort of imaging you use. Traditionally, we've used x-rays, but as life has evolved, so has imaging, and so we're more and more frequently using CT. And from the April issue, you'll see that when you look at this issue from a trauma hospital perspective, then they would almost universally use CT for anyone who had any of the positive nexus criteria. Out in the more real world, or perhaps more general practice, and also where you don't have access to CT in the immediate vicinity, you might still need to use plain X-ray imaging. And the important points there are that you have to make sure that you do image the whole cervical spine. That's a really important point, because certainly there are cases where C7 T1 dislocation has been missed because all of the vertebrae aren't seen on the lateral view. We need to have five views usually. That includes a lateral view, the peg view, which is where you see the odontoid peg as a peg, a bit emanating superiorly from the bodies of the C2 vertebral body, and you're checking the alignment there between C1 and C2, so that's the peg view. You need an AP view of the whole of the cervical spine, and what we're looking at there is just the general alignment of the spinous processes being midline and making sure there isn't one that's stepped away from the others. Then the other two views are the oblique views, and they're done with the patient in a collar. They're done by rotating the X-ray tube around so that you don't have to move the patient. But those ones are extremely helpful for checking the alignments of the facet joints, because when you get a fracture dislocation at a facet joint, often the abnormality on the lateral view is reasonably subtle. I guess then that makes everyone all feel a bit uncertain about interpreting the cervical spine X-ray, but it is, if you keep to the basic rules, you must have see all seven cervical vertebrae, you look at the lateral view and you're looking for the alignment and checking very carefully. There are generally four lines. There's a pre-vertebral soft tissue line, which is important, and I'll just come back to that in a minute. The anterior vertebral body line should line up. It shouldn't have any millimetres difference between any of the anterior vertebral bodies. The posterior vertebral body line is the next one. And then there's the spinolaminar line, which I've illustrated in figure 11, which is where that's the line that where the lamina join the spinous processes, and that sounds all a bit confusing, but you can see a distinct curve that you join up rather than joining up the posterior aspects of the spinous processes because they're of differing sizes. If you join up those lines on the X-ray, then it's a very smooth curve normally. So if any of those lines are broken, then it means that there's likely to be a fracture present, and you should obviously leave the patient immobilised and get further imaging and assistance for them. With the anterior soft tissue line, you're looking for soft tissue swelling there, and in the upper cervical spine it's usually quite small, well less than a vertebral body. In the lower cervical spine below C4-5, it becomes about a vertebral body's thickness, and if it's any thicker than that, you need to move on. But there are measurements of 3 millimetres at C2 and 7 millimetres at, sorry, that should be less than 2 centimetres at C7 and less than 7 millimetres at C2, but those measurements are also a bit difficult to measure, but you know that it should be quite thin, and if there's any distortion of that line, if it becomes thick as your thumb or thick as the vertebral body in the upper cervical spine, you should be very concerned. So that's basically how you interpret it. If you have any concerns, then you would move the patient in immobilisation with spinal precautions and get further imaging and assistance for them.
And checking the odontoid peg and the lateral masses of C1.
Yeah, so on the peg view, what you're looking for there is that the peg is quite midline in relation to the C1 lateral mass, as they're called. So they should be equidistant, the peg, from one lateral mass to the other. So you shouldn't have one side where the gap is larger. And likewise, where the C1 lateral masses, it's basically the body of C1, sits onto the lateral masses of C2, it shouldn't overlap. And if it overlaps, then you've got to be concerned there might be a C1 fracture. And in the case that I've used to illustrate is, again, it's not a particularly obvious case, but usually in an elderly patient where they frequently fracture through the base of the odontoid peg, and then the whole conjoined articulating C1 and C2 peg move posteriorly in relation to the majority of the C2 vertebral body. So, but if you use the rules, you can see that everything's sitting too far posteriorly and that there is an abnormal lucency crossing the base of the peg.
So it can make, I guess, looking at a cervical spine X-ray can make GPs a bit nervous, but if you use the systematic approach, you can be pretty safe.
Yes, I think so. And if you think anything's abnormal, then you just leave the immobilisation on and have them transferred away for further imaging.
For further imaging, yeah.
Yeah.
And the systematic approach and the pattern recognition is also important with abdominal X-rays. And the last two cases in this article are abdominal X-rays. One demonstrates a small bowel obstruction, one a large bowel obstruction.
Yeah.
What's the pattern recognition there?
So I think the important point there is to know where to look for small bowel and when you're looking for large bowel. And in the large bowel obstructions, it's often a bit confusing because there's such a lot of gas around. But you know that is just a couple of basic rules, really, that the small bowel should be really less than 3 centimetres in diameter, and it would certainly have ruptured by the time it reached 10, whereas often in a patient who's an elderly patient, perhaps demented, chronic constipation, their large bowel will be significantly larger than that. The large bowel also is more peripherally located, of course, but once you get someone who's got long-standing chronic constipation, often it's the whole abdomen's filled with bowel. So the pattern is really in a small bowel obstruction. They're relatively smaller loops. They're centrally located. You won't see a lot of large, if it's a complete bowel obstruction, you won't see a lot of large bowel gas because of the obstruction, very little is getting through, and therefore there's no gas in the large bowel, so you're not really confused with that peripheral picture of large bowel gas. And you get dilated loops which frequently stack on one another like sausages in the centre of the abdomen, and the example given is a bit like that. And when you do the erect view, you see air fluid levels, and that's from the interface between air and fluid in the bowel. Can't move along, and those air fluid levels are usually relatively long and numerous in number. And that's how you tell the small bowel obstruction. So centrally oriented sausage-like loops in the supine projection, lots of air fluid levels on the erect view, and very little peripheral large bowel gas. In the large bowel obstruction, it's frequently, well, of three types, I suppose, from chronic constipation and volvulus. So it might be sigmoid volvulus or cecal volvulus, or it's equally or perhaps more frequently due to an obstructing lesion. Sometimes that's diverticulitis, but more often it's due to cancer. In that situation of an obstructing lesion and carcinoma, you will see dilatation of the large bowel proximal to the stenosis and then very little gas distal to it. So if you've, for example, got an obstructing cancer in the transverse colon, the cecum will become quite dilated, and we get very concerned if the cecum gets beyond 10 to 11 centimetres or so. If you had a sigmoid obstructing cancer, then almost all of the large bowel will be distended, but you'll notice there'll be no rectal gas, so you look in that round circle of the central pelvis and there'll be no gas in the rectum. So you're looking for a pattern of dilatation and what's distal or not distal to it. So if there's no bowel distal to it, then you're very suspicious that if you've got distended large bowel proximal to an area, that there's a stricture or stenosis, stenosing lesion. In the sigmoid volvulus, which is another very common cause of obstruction or pseudo-obstruction, because they intimately obstruct and unobstruct, what you get there is a very, very large distended loop which is emanating out of the pelvis. And the example I've given there in figure 16 is one of those where really, and I've traced around the edge of that loop, and you can see that it comes out of the pelvis and really fills the whole abdomen. The sigmoid colon can become very, very, very dilated. And yet it's just a frequent situation for these patients where they get intermittently obstructed and then untwist often. If they just put a tube in just to deflate the cecum, the sigmoid colon, it'll resolve itself and they'll get back to their normal state of play.
And the other way to distinguish between large and small bowels, you described the valvulae conventi versus the Hastra.
Yeah, so, and that's really relevant mostly when you don't have, or when you've got a little less distension, perhaps when you're in the situation where you're trying to decide in an early case of someone's got pain and they've got a history of abdominal surgery, as they frequently do, and you're wondering whether they're obstructed or not, and you're trying to work out whether in an abdomen that doesn't have a lot of gas in it, whether you're looking at small or large bowel, and that's where you want to use those techniques to work out whether you're looking at small bowel. And small bowel has these valvulae conventi, which are the mucosal folds which cross across the whole width of the bowel, whereas the large bowel Hastra are between the strips of smooth muscle, which are in three major strips, and so they just indent the edge of the bowel, they never cross the whole way. So when you're trying to determine whether you're talking about small bowel or not, you're talking about position, because it's normally central in someone who's got normally rotated bowel, which is most of us. So central, the valvulae conventi is never greater than 3 centimetres in size. The peripheral Hastral lines, very dilated or more dilated or in larger calibre in a normal situation, then that's your large bowel. So that's the main
difference,
valvulae.
Well, thanks very much for your article and just some really sort of basic and sensible principles that GPs can use to interpret basic x-rays.
Thank you, Kath.
Okay, thanks for talking to AFP Audio today.
Pleasure.